The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the live recording of the Short Circuit podcast. We are happy to be here at Georgia Law. Thank you to the Federalist Society and to the American Constitution Society for hosting us. If you law students out there want us to come to your law school to record a podcast, let us know and we will figure something out. My name is Anya Bidwal. I'm an attorney with the Institute for Justice and IJ's Elfie Galoon Fellow for Freedom and the Constitution. Before we begin, let me just briefly mention two things. First, IJ has these two great programs for law students and young lawyers. If you are a 1L, consider applying to be our paid summer clerk during the summer of 2021. If you are about to graduate or are looking for constitutional law opportunities following your clerkships, apply to be our Law and Liberty Fellow in our DC area headquarters. Second, if you like our Short Circuit podcast, tune in to our sister podcast called Bound by Oath. It's in a documentary format, and over a series of one-hour episodes, it explores important constitutional issues and their effect on individual lives. The first season is focused on the history of the 14th Amendment and the rights it guarantees. Listen to it on any podcast platform or online. The second season is in the making and will be available this summer. It will focus on the obstacles created by federal courts to enforcing these constitutional rights. With that, let me turn to today's podcast, in which we will discuss two fascinating 11th Circuit opinions, as well as one opinion out of Georgia Court of Appeals. Our panelists are Michael Wells, an acclaimed professor at Georgia Law who teaches and publishes in the areas of torts, federal courts, and constitutional litigation, Eric Siegel, an acclaimed professor at Georgia State University, who also specializes in the areas of federal courts and constitutional law, and Andrew Fleischman, a well-known appellate attorney here in Georgia, who, in the course of his still young career, has handled over 60 appeals. Eric and Andrew, how about you two tell us briefly about how you know each other?
Well, I was Professor Siegel's student about 10 years ago, and I remember it very vividly.
Andrew was a great student, and I'm honored and proud that I'm on a panel with a former student. That's always one of the most fun things I get to do.
Oh, come on, let's be honest here.
Honestly, I think I got a B minus, but happy to be here.
Excellent. So before we delve into the opinions, let's briefly talk about Georgia's state judiciary as well as the 11th Circuit. Andrew, could you quickly explain to us how the state judiciary here works?
Well, we've got a Supreme Court of Georgia and a Court of Appeals. The Supreme Court of Georgia was created in 1836, and it was designed to deal with all the things that wealthy white plantation owners wanted to deal with, which is to say divorce and land disputes and also occasionally murders and whether killing a slave was technically a crime. All those issues went to the Supreme Court of Georgia. Later, we created a Court of Appeals to deal with a less important issue, like basically every crime other than murder. Gradually, we've moved a lot of stuff from the Supreme Court of Georgia down to the Court of Appeals. So, for instance, divorces are not all handled at the highest court in Georgia, which that used to be. That was an effort to reduce caseload. So now in Georgia, we have this intermediate court, the Court of Appeals. Most things go directly there. And then if you think the Court of Appeals made a mistake or made an important ruling, you go to the Supreme Court of Georgia for cert. That's the case we're talking about here today.
Excellent. Just mention briefly, so the case that you discussed, the Christopher Glenn case, there it says physical precedent only. What is it and how does it work exactly?
The Georgia Court of Appeals has a truly bizarre rule. They call the physical precedent rule, which is to say you've got three judges on each panel, and sometimes one of them doesn't fully agree with everything that's said in the main opinion. He says, I concur in judgment only. And that means you cannot cite the case as precedential. It's not unpublished, it's just not precedential. And it's one of the most frustrating and confusing parts of Georgia jurisprudence because the judge never says why, or oftentimes doesn't. So you've got a case that says something really great for your client, like, oh man, this is not enough to prove constructive possession of a bunch of meth in a house. Great, I want to use that case. And the Court of Appeals will come back and say, that was physical precedent only. One of the people on the panel, they agreed with it, but not entirely, and so we won't cite it. It's a frustrating and difficult rule. They're moving away from that physical precedent-only rule, which has been a big improvement. And my hope is that eventually we'll do away with it altogether. We can just cite cases for their reasoning and hope they stick.
What's the difference between physical precedent and no precedent?
You get to read physical precedent. So unpublished opinions are hidden on the website. You can't get them on Westlaw or Lexis. which is a shame because oftentimes the wrongest opinions are the unpublished ones. And they're in my experience as an appellate litigator, I often am more likely to seek cert on an unpublished opinion because that typically means the Court of Appeals think this is a routine or normal opinion. To give you an example, last year I had a case that Georgia has a rape shield statute that prevents you from bringing up stuff sexually about a victim. And it says the only exception to the rape shield statute is when a defendant wants to bring it up to rebut certain types of claims. The state claimed that it didn't apply to them at all, and they could bring up as much of a victim's sexual history as they wanted to. And in this case, they talked about how a child acted out sexually after she was molested. She was extremely embarrassed. They talked about it in front of the court. I said that this was wrong. The Court of Appeals says, well, it's not in the text of the statute, but we assume the intent of the legislature was that you couldn't raise these rape shield issues against the state. The Supreme Court of Georgia took that unpublished case and said, no, this is crazy. We can't believe you guys have been doing this. We hadn't noticed because all these opinions were unpublished. But obviously, you got to follow the text of the statute. Fiscal precedent only, you can at least read and rebut and respond to. And oftentimes, that reasoning is persuasive for courts.
And to all three of you out there, do you think that that kind of puts some pressure on judges to actually issue unanimous opinions? Does it kind of change the system of incentives when they develop their opinions, given that if somebody dissents, like in one of the cases we'll discuss today, then it's just marked as physical precedent only?
Well, if anything, it encourages judges not to issue proper dissents, right? Because
right.
If you don't want an opinion to be precedential, you could either go through all the hard work of writing down the reasons why you disagree or think the opinion could be better written, or you
can
write
go along.
J-O yeah. on the bottom, and you've gotten the same result without effort. Now, that's good for judges. It lets them avoid creating precedent they don't want to create. It's bad for everybody else who wants to be able to read cases and know what the law is, and who wants cases to decide things instead of just deciding for that one case only, which is what fiscal precedent means.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of precedent is a rule of law idea that similarly situated people should be treated similarly. And I think the whole idea of unpublished opinions is a little bit difficult to deal with in the first place. I understand why it costs and work effort go into that. As a general proposition, I think all published opinions should have whatever precedential value they have. And the idea that you can say, this is a published opinion, but you can't rely on it, seems anti-rule of law to me.
Do you have anything to add, Professor Walls?
No, I think all that's true. I run into this physical precedent only idea sometimes in teaching torts especially. And I find it frustrating just as a professor to know what it might mean, you know.
I've definitely had cases where I have so many good cases, and there's eight of them. They're all physical precedent only, which means I can talk about the reasoning and why they're great, but the court doesn't have to follow.
One panel of the Georgia Court of Appeals is bound by other panel decisions, right?
If they read them.
If they read them. Well, no, I mention that because as a person who self-identifies as a core legal realist, when we're talking about, for example, the Georgia Supreme Court, which, you know, is not bound, obviously, by Court of Appeals opinions and which can change its own opinions. I don't really believe judges care a lot about precedent anyway. So it should be an all or nothing thing. Either a case should be precedential or it shouldn't be. We're in some kind of weird, murky land here of Georgia Court of Appeals cases where some are and some aren't. That strikes me as just befuddling and puzzling to everybody and a truly bad idea.
So one distinction between Georgia and other states like Texas, for instance, is that most other states have individual courts of appeals that are geographic. So you're in Houston, you go to one court of appeals, and
two.
You can, oh, two.
Yep.
Okay, two. There's two.
First and 14th.
First and 14th. Okay, so you got two to pick from. You got a smorgasbord.
It's a big state, and we'll talk about this being a big circuit later. But yes, in Houston happened the same thing as happened between the Fifth Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit when Fifth Circuit actually had to be divided into two. That's what happened in Houston as well.
Fair enough. So you can be in an area and you know what the precedent is in your area at least because you're going to get the same panel every time. In Georgia, it's a lottery. And which judges you get switches randomly. Sometimes somebody retires or leaves and you just slot somebody else in. And so there's really no telling which precedent they're going to find compelling. And it's hard to say that one thing is binding on the court.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Let's transition briefly and let's talk about the 11th Circuit. It's not as complicated. So the 11th Circuit covers Alabama, Florida, and Georgia. As you guys know, it sits in Atlanta. There are 12 active judges, seven of whom are Republican appointees. There are also 10 senior status judges. It is a relatively new circuit court. It was created in 1981 after the 5th Circuit was reorganized due to its overwhelming docket. So all the pre-1981 Fifth Circuit precedent is binding on the 11th Circuit. So Eric, why don't you start us off with the case about the last mass lynching in American history?
Sure, and I should say I clerked for the 11th Circuit many, many years ago, and I'm originally from New York, but I spent most of my time in the South. And when I was clerking in 1985 and 6 for the 11th Circuit, there was still a very strong feeling of camaraderie and cooperation among the judges, kind of in the old Southern way. I think that's changed now. And I think, especially with a 7-5 political split, there's going to be some serious dissenting opinions.
So interesting. So you clerked in 1984, you said, right?
I clerked for a district court judge from 83 to 85 and 11th Circuit judge from 85 to 86.
Okay. And in your opinion, the kind of the camaraderie deteriorated?
I was there, but it has since then, I think. I should also say I got to know some of the most courageous American judges in history of the old Fifth Circuit, who did a lot of desegregation work when their houses were being bombed. Judge Tuttle and Judge Wisdom and some other ones. Judge Wisdom is a great name, right? And
yes, there's a courthouse in his name.
Yes. But anyway, okay. So we're going to talk today about Pitch versus United States. This is a case involving what many people consider to be the last mass lynching in America. In 1946, tragically, two African-American couples were basically dragged to a tree, tied to that tree, and then shot. And it was a horrific episode, and one very important to the civil rights movement in America. This happened all very publicly. And eventually, the FBI did investigate, and a grand jury was impaneled, if that's the right word for grand jury, but a grand jury was impaneled to investigate. No prosecutions were brought, despite the fact that these horrific murders happened in plain view in front of a lot of people. Since that time, the case has been reopened on a couple occasions, but again, no one has ever been charged or indicted or arrested for this horrific crime. The issue in Pitch versus United States is Mr. Pitch is an author and historian, and he's written about this incident, and he wants to write more about it, and he wants to unseal the grand jury materials to write about it. Generally speaking, and for obviously good reasons, grand jury materials are secret.
What kind of, so give us an example of the kind of grand jury material that they're looking
well,
to
I'm testimony, probably.
Unseal here. The testimony of
witnesses to the
mm-hmm.
event.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe depositions and other things. And the policy reasons for keeping grand jury material secret are obvious. We want to protect the witnesses and make sure they speak honestly and truthfully. We don't want to tip off potential defendants who might be subject to prosecution. And the federal rules have a set of exceptions to people, to the secrecy, but they all involve official governmental entities. Most of them do. So the question here is, when there's a case of historical significance, and this clearly was that, this is the horrible murder in rural Georgia, never solved, part of the civil rights movement. 70 years later, an author wants those grand jury materials unsealed. He wants to see them. And a panel of the 11th Circuit agreed with two other circuits and said there is inherent authority among district court judges to allow the release of materials pertaining to historically significant events many, 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 many years later. That exception is not in the statute. So the 11th Circuit held that the district court had this authority, but it's going on bank. So we don't know what that means. The entire circuit is going to hear it. We don't know what they're going to do. There's a lot of formalism and formalistic legal arguments involved in this case. So I'll just give you two really quick. The government is arguing, among other things, that the statute has some exceptions. Those are the only exceptions. So when you list, you know, three or four exceptions to something, then there's a kind of a canon of legal argument that says you've listed the exceptions, there are no more. The counterargument to that is district courts have always had inherent authority to release grand jury materials. The Federal Criminal Rules of Civil Procedure don't explicitly take away that authority. So a counter canon is inherent authority is not taken away unless it's done explicitly. None of that is really going to convince any of the judges how to vote in this case. Formal legal rules don't decide cases. Hearts, politics, and values decide cases. And this one is really hard. On the one hand, the people who perpetrated this crime were probably dead, but their children aren't. And their relatives might not be. And to release the grand jury materials might put some people in bad light in a way that we don't necessarily want. In addition, someone pointed out to me on Twitter this morning, a very good criminal defense attorney, that if you're dead, you can't clear your name. And if there's incriminating evidence against a dead person in these materials and their name gets, you know, dragged through the mud, that person has no recourse to that. On the other hand, these lynchings are an incredibly important historical event. They are unsolved. Let's assume for the moment there was some kind of mass cover-up, which there probably was, given that nobody was ever charged and there's a public lynching of, you know, four people. And the public has a very strong interest, I think, in trying to figure out what happened. In the past, some grand jury materials have been released in famous cases. The Rosenberg trial, Ethel Rosenberg was put to death for treason. Grand jury materials relating to her and her family were released and gave new information about it.
Just for the audience out there, tell us briefly about Rosenberg.
Well, they were just people accused of being communist sympathizers and passing secrets to communists in the 1950s. It's a major episode in the Cold War of American history. More recently, though, Richard Nixon's deposition in the Watergate hearings to a grand jury was released, and interesting information was gleaned from that. So the balance is this. On the one hand, we want in a democracy to understand important historical events, especially when the government may have been involved in a cover-up of that controversy. On the other hand, there are compelling reasons to keep grand jury materials secret. Here's my proposed solution. It's very quick. I think district courts should have discretion to release them. I think that discretion should almost never be exercised. I think it should be exercised in very rare cases. Where pitch lies in that is on the line, which makes it even harder. But I think in light of the fact that these lynchings took place publicly, in front of a lot of people, and no prosecution was ever brought, no arrest was ever made, the American people have a strong interest in learning as much as possible about this event. And I think in this case, the panel got it right. But I don't feel strongly about that and could probably be convinced otherwise.
So why do you think, and obviously nobody can know, but why was the opinion vacated and the en banc review granted? What is going on there? What do you think is the court worried about?
Well, the court is worried about district court judges releasing grand jury materials in cases maybe less important than this one. There also may be a formalist argument going on here, which is there is a federal rule dealing with the release of grand jury materials, and it doesn't allow for this exception of historically significant events. But again, there are counter-formalistic arguments.
They also, hold on just one second, sorry about this. They're discussing precedent, Hastings.
Yes.
And they're saying that we're very much bound by precedent and essentially there's nothing we can do. Do you think there is any kind of... go ahead.
Let me be clear.
Yeah.
So the one 11th Circuit panel is bound by another 11th Circuit panel. In this case, they did say they were bound by that prior case. They're not, and they weren't. There were 1,000 ways to distinguish that prior case. If the panel had, like all cases involving precedent, unless it's directly 100% on point, they could have said, for example, that case involved one of the exceptions in the statute, not directly, but indirectly. There's an exception for judicial proceedings. That exception, no one is saying applies here. They could have said that in the opinion. What they cited that precedent for was there are exceptions other than ones in the statute. But they could have distinguished that case. For most appellate courts, this is now a broad statement about constitutional law or any other law in this country. For most appellate courts, if they want to distinguish a case, they can distinguish a case. And precedent only matters when they think it matters. That's my core legal
Breaking
realism.
Breaking news!
Yeah, that's my core legal realism coming out. Yesterday, Justices Thomas and Gorsuch wrote a concurring opinion where they explicitly said they wanted to overturn a whole series of cases involving a Bivens cause of action.
Yeah, Hastings, Hernandez versus Mesa, where a Mexican teenager was shot and killed across the border.
My only point is Preston is only good if the judges later think that it's good.
One additional basis they might have gone on bank was that there was out of the D.C. Circuit a cert petition to the Supreme Court pending about whether or not grand jury records could be released. And though I'm not a mind reader, it could be the 11th Circuit wanted to make sure they had the best reasoned and most thorough opinion out on that issue before.
The 2nd Circuit and 7th Circuit have both held that there's an exception for historical events. The D.C. Circuit rejected that. And this is all heading to the Supreme Court, I would think, at some point.
You heard it here first, maybe.
They just denied cert January 19th, I think. But eventually, yeah.
Can we briefly discuss sort of the concurrence where the judge is kind of basically showing doubts, right, and showing reasoning that they're dealing with, and also dissent?
Well, I think what judges write down isn't always what's in their hearts and minds. And most of the arguments in the case involved formalistic legal arguments about what do you do when Congress makes some exceptions? Are there other exceptions available? And what do we do with inherent district court authority when it's not explicitly overturned but put seriously in? I don't think that's what's going on here. What's going on here is, in the 11th Circuit on bank consideration of this case, I think what the judges are really going to look at is how important is it for the public to learn about historical events versus the potential for harm in releasing grand jury materials. And I want to be clear, there is no right answer to that question. That question, this will sound familiar to Andrew, who heard me say this in class many times. Judge Richard Posner, the most famous judge ever not on the Supreme Court, in my opinion, was famous for saying that constitutional law is not about logic, it's about values. And I think if one cares a lot about the American people learning about it at important historical events, you would side on that side. If one cares more about protecting the grand jury process, one will rule that way, and everything else is noise.
I think formalistically, if you are a formalist, that there are two things.
I hope you're not.
that are butting. I have to at least pretend to be in my day job. I gotta make those arguments. You've got precedent. You've got lots of other circuits agreeing that 6E applies, and you also have this rather ingenious argument that's made that at some point, this is about 2012, they were considering amending this rule 6E to add as a special exception historically important events. And the panel gave their reasoning, and they're basically like, "Oh no, we're not going to do that because this is already covered." Now, normally, formalist judges are really reluctant to use that sort of thing as precedent because you can't know what's in the hearts and minds of rulemakers, and the text is the best explanation of what they meant. But here, they totally ignored that and just went with it. It's actually a pretty good argument, right? If everybody who read the rule and understood it thought that, and circuits had already ruled that way, then we should read this rule as allowing that. There's this idea, especially in statutory interpretation, that stare decisis is a little stronger. So once you interpret a rule or text a particular way, it's so easy for people to change it that you shouldn't change your interpretation unless you have a great reason, because the rulemaker could always change it if he disagreed with you.
But my former student is underestimating the degree to which non-legal, non-formalistic considerations play in cases like this. And when I say cases like this, what I really mean is this is hard. I mean, it's hard. I mean, I don't think anyone could say as a policy matter what the right answer should be here. So I think one just has to take a position on whether grand jury material should be secret forever, and there is a good reason for that, or whether one thinks the American people should be able to learn about important historical events from long ago, and there's a good reason for that. And at the end of the day, intuition and values and hunches are going to rule the day, not gleaning legal rules from silence or legislative history.
Excellent.
Can I add one very strong opinion, which is that grand jury secrecy is bogus and does not protect people at all? it's not. So, you know, grand juries were originally a tool of tyranny. They were a way for a king to drag people into a court-passed proceeding and get information. Then we passed the Magna Carta and became seen as something as a protection. And at the time of the founding, which is why we have it in the Fifth Amendment, it was somewhat protective. You would have people in your community, anywhere from 12 to 26, deciding whether or not you were going to be charged with a crime. There were not professional prosecutors. There were no professional police. They would just call people in and talk to them and figure out whether to charge you. And that, those days are gone. Now a prosecutor comes in. In North Carolina, there was a case where they found that in one day, grand juries were issuing indictments every 48 seconds. That is the level of scrutiny that you get. So when we talk about how you can indict a ham sandwich, that's what we mean. The average grand jury is a police officer coming in and summarizing the case for the grand jury who asks no questions. And when, by some mistake, somebody good ends up in that grand jury, as happened in Missouri, somebody from the ACLU made it onto the grand jury and started asking questions about police misconduct, they struck the grand jury immediately and created a new one so they wouldn't have to deal with it, which he sued about and which he lost on. So we say,
what was the reasoning?
Oh, that's just something they could statutorily do. So it didn't matter whether they were doing it on the basis of viewpoint. So when we talk about, oh, grand jury secrecy is so important, what happens after an indictment issues? Well, they issue a press release. They tell people what you're charged with. Somehow, journalists know the exact time that you're going to be arrested, and they wait outside your house, and they drag you out in handcuffs. How do they know that if grand jury secrecy is so important? Because somebody from the prosecutor's office or the police department calls them and tells them to be there. So we don't protect people's secrecy in this way. What we protect is the right to say dishonest things at grand jury proceedings. Let's say I'm a Georgia defendant, which someday may happen, who knows, and I want to know, what did they say at that grand jury? Were they telling the same story to that grand jury they're telling here today? Or did the facts change once they became aware of the motions I'm filing and my legal theory of the case? I can't find out, not even in death penalty cases. And Georgia court reporters are sworn to secrecy. It's a crime for them to release the transcripts of those grand juries. So far from being a tool that protects people as it did at the time of the founding, it has become a tool to oppress them, to drag people in to get information, to force them to take the Fifth, to put them into awkward situations, as happens federally, or to issue that ham sandwich indictment, get you charged, and then ruin all that secrecy by putting those allegations publicly.
I agree with every syllable that was just uttered. I do think, however, it doesn't help us in this case, because a case that happened 70 years ago, think about if your father or mother was a suspect, and they were never charged, never prosecuted. And now this information comes out, which can't be verified, which they can't rebut. I do think there might be compelling reasons. As I say, I would release the materials, but there could be some compelling reasons to keep those written documents secret now, even if everything you just said was right.
That's true. This is probably the best case, actually, because I think if you asked a criminal defense lawyer like me, would you rather abolish grand juries tomorrow? I would say yes. Let's do away with them. I would much rather have what's called a preliminary or a probable cause hearing, where at least I get to ask that guy some questions in front of a judge, get some information about the case, potentially poke holes or lock him into a story, which I don't get. I don't even get to know the grand jury indictment is occurring.
It is kind of a star chamber.
It's exactly a star chamber. And on top of everything else, prosecutors in this state, I don't know about elsewhere, will routinely say, we won't talk to you about a bond if you insist on a probable cause hearing. Or we'll only offer you this low bond if you agree to no probable cause hearing. It's very important to them that you not get a chance to learn about their case. Because if it's something like a murder and not something important, like a slip and fall at a supermarket, you don't get depositions. You don't get to talk to the witnesses in advance. So the goal here is to keep you in the dark for as long as possible, which grand juries help to serve. So we talk about this and the importance of secrecy as though it offers any protection to the defendant, and I want to just say no. At this point, grand juries are purely a tool of the state used to make convictions come easier.
But it does protect witnesses, though.
Yes,
it protects witnesses. And to Eric's point, a friend of the core, a friend of IJ and Short Circuit Podcast, Professor Fred Smith, who teaches at Emory, he has a forthcoming paper on essentially the rights of deceased. Right. And he cites the dissent in this case in the paper to kind of try to grapple with this idea.
And that's interesting. Fred's a friend of mine and as progressive a person as you're ever going to find, I think it's fair to say. But so he thinks, and so what you're suggesting is he thinks these materials should not be released, which shows this is not a, and that's one of the rare things about this case. It's not a political issue. In other words, your politics, whether you're liberal, conservative, progressive or not, don't really matter. It's just a hard balancing test.
How very refreshing.
Though at common law, how does it deal with the fact that, you know, historically, you can't libel the dead? I can go in here and say George Washington strangled 8 puppies. And that's a fact. And I know it based on hidden sources. I can say that all day long and I can't be sued. So why offer special protections to grand juries for the deceased that we don't offer in common law?
Well, because I think there's things short of defamation suits that are just right and wrong. And I this case is hard because it was so heinous, so awful, and because we know what 1946 Georgia was like, it is very probable the government was involved in a terrible cover-up. But if there were innocent people dragged into this mess and their relatives still alive have no way of clearing up that ambiguity, I think that's hard. But I do think, given that race is today and always has been America's number one social, cultural, political issue, I think the interest in this particular event should be very high.
That's an excellent way to wrap it up. And let's, Andrew, how about you talk about Christopher Glenn?
Okay, Christopher Glenn, this is such a simple little case, but it's got big implications for Georgia. So Christopher Glenn is on probation, just like about 500,000 Georgians. He's on probation, and one day he's walking in the park, which, for the record, is legal. So two police officers spot him in the park, and they decide that he shouldn't be there. And they start asking him why he's there and what's going on. And Glenn, to his credit, doesn't want to go alone. He wants to keep walking and go on his way. So they decide they're going to arrest him. And it's a long struggle, right? They're moving him to the first squad car, and he's complaining about, you know, being out of breath. So they move him to an ambulance. And then they try to drag him from the ambulance to a second car, and he's struggling and he's fighting them. And then they finally put him to a third car in a cage. And in some Herculean feat of strength, while he's in the third car, he kicks the door until it falls off the hinges, which does not suggest good engineering. If you're going to make a special patrol car with cages, the door should stay on when you kick it. Doesn't. So he doesn't get charged with a crime. Instead, they do what's called a revocation proceeding. So probation is a privilege, we're told. It's a privilege to be on probation. You could be in jail, but we've decided we're just going to closely monitor you outside the world. And if you mess up, if it can show by a preponderance that you've done something bad, we can put you in jail for anywhere from 2 years up to the total term of your sentence. So they do the revocation, and the judge does something really remarkable. He says, gosh, I think you weren't trespassing or loitering. I think you had a right to be in the park. And when those officers were grabbing you and you were struggling and fighting them, I think you were justified in doing that too. Because Georgia's obstruction law, almost unique because most laws have changed, requires that you knowingly and willfully hinder a law enforcement officer in the course of his lawful duties. Which is to say that if a police officer is arresting you for no good reason and you fight him, that is not a crime in Georgia. So he says, I'm justified. And the judge says, yes, I agree. But when you were in that car, you kicked the door off its hinges. That was not justified because you cannot be justified in destroying property. Now, as an appellate attorney, that is the absolute most beautiful phrase you could hear. I agree with you on the facts, but I've got my own interpretation of the law. Why is that the best thing that could happen for an appellate attorney? Because judges get no deference, on legal questions. A higher court is going to rule on that issue, what's called de novo, looking at it for the first time. So Mr. Glenn goes up to the Court of Appeals of Georgia, and he says, again, hey, I think that kicking the door down actually was justified. This was a false imprisonment. One thing that kind of gets lost, because nobody ever gets arrested, is that almost every Fourth Amendment violation is a crime. Holding somebody without a good reason is false imprisonment. Moving them somewhere is kidnapping. Searching your home to look for stuff without a warrant is burglary. We're all justified in resisting those things. And so we would be justified similarly in stopping an officer who's doing it. But what the state said was, listen, once he was in the car, regardless of whether he was justified, the harm was no longer imminent. You know, he, at that point, was just continuing to struggle. And you can kind of see the specter they're dealing with here. Imagine you're wrongfully arrested, right? And you're innocent as the day is long, and they put you in a cell. And to escape your false imprisonment, you put two sticks of dynamite in the window and blow your way out. Okay. Now, do we want to say that's justified? Okay, at some point, maybe it's not imminent. So what the Court of Appeals does is they look at the case, and they say, well, we reviewed the video. Now, for the record, the officers in this case said that this guy was fighting continuously, and that he was kicking the door as soon as he was put in the car. But the Court of Appeals says we reviewed the video independently, which is something the Court of Appeals of Georgia likes to do a lot, and we've decided he didn't start kicking the door until 15 minutes after he was in the patrol car. And because of that, it was not imminent.
What wasn't imminent?
His destruction of the property was not in response to imminent violence by the state, which is what's required for justification. right? To be justified, you have to be responding to imminent force, and here it's not imminent. So actually, on behalf of the Georgia Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, I wrote an amicus brief on this, and we talked about what that means. For instance, let's say you're an 8-year-old child locked in a man's trunk, and he's driving down the road with you, and you decide you would like to kick your way out of the trunk so that you won't be kidnapped. If he's in the process of moving
That's a similar hypothetical that dissent mentions, right?
That's exactly what the dissent mentions, and Judge McFadden talks about this. If you kick your way out of the trunk to escape your kidnapper, or if you break the duct tape that's holding you, or if you bust out of a building that's holding you after you've been captured, kidnapped, like Miss Smart, is that imminent? Are you justified? And if it's not, is it just prosecutorial discretion that stops us from charging kidnapping victims who escape their captors by wrecking something? Should we say you shouldn't have snapped those handcuffs? And what is the absurdity here if you were allowed to use force against the officer but not against his property? So I could shoot the police officer to stop him from coming into my home, but I can't damage his shirt. I've got to aim for the head. That seems like a pretty crazy rule. And that's what Judge McFadden talks about here. He writes a dissent. He says, listen, if we're going to say that this false imprisonment isn't imminent, that's got consequences beyond this case. There's nothing specifically about this case that's about it being a cop who's doing it. And you should be able to kick your way out of a kidnapper's trunk even if it has government plates. So there's a petition for cert, and the Supreme Court of Georgia has granted that cert. So currently we're waiting on oral argument in the case, which, by the way, as Georgia students, you should know, Georgia has the best video system in the country for its oral arguments, and it's one of the best ways to sharpen your advocacy. You can go to the Supreme Court of Georgia and watch all of those arguments as they happen, and they archive them for a full year afterwards.
Texas Supreme Court does the same thing.
They are great, too. And so this is a great place for you
actually,
to go.
Sorry, this is something I'm obsessed with. Almost every state in the country, most states allow either live streaming or cameras in the courtrooms. It is only and most countries do that. It is only our highest court that doesn't do that. Not only, but
circuit courts, federal circuit courts are quite good as well, right? You can at least listen to the audio.
They're starting to get better. But if the Supreme Court were to do it, then all the circuit courts would go along. I know we're on a tangent here. I'm sorry. But there is no reason why Supreme Court proceedings shouldn't be on television.
Sorry. Well, the worry is always that it's going to be a circus. There's a great Georgia case, actually, where there's a woman in a DUI case, a prosecutor. She's in court, and the defendant in this case was wearing a back brace, and his lawyer lifted his shirt to show it to the jury, to show he couldn't have, that's the reason he did badly on a walk and turn a DUI case. So this appellate lawyer for the state of Georgia comes into court wearing a back brace hidden underneath her jacket, pulls it up for the court to show how unfair it would be. And the Court of Appeals just excoriates her in the opinion. Typically when that happens, the person ends up being a judge later. I haven't checked.
just on this subject real quick, Justice Namias of the Georgia Supreme Court, Judge Dillard of the Georgia Court of Appeals, and Justice Willett of the Texas Supreme Court, who's now a Fifth Circuit judge, mm-hmm. all at a symposium I ran 2 years ago, presented compelling evidence that live streaming appellate hearings is fantastic, interesting, we should do it, and I trust those three judges, if only the Supreme Court of the United States would listen to them.
And also, as an advocate, can I say, depending on where you sit in the room, you can or can't see your opponent at the desk while you're talking, and if you know which seat to be in, you can watch your opponent's face the whole time you're talking, and you can see if he reacts, whether that might be a point you want to press on later. I know that's weird, but it's actually a pretty effective. All these little things can help you as an advocate. And of course, if I'm on video, I want to be seen being competent, right? I don't want to get up there and start, I don't know, spinning in circles. Hopefully say something good. So yes, I agree thoroughly. It enhances professionalism. But yeah, on this case, the real question is, when is it imminent and when does it stop being imminent? Because there probably is a line to draw.
Where would you draw the line?
Where would I draw the line? I think that, so in Georgia, kidnapping is a continuous offense. I think as long as you are arguably preventing that from happening, I think the arrest is the process of taking you down to the station. As long as you're preventing that unlawful arrest and kidnapping, as long as you're being asportated, that's the legal term, and that continuing offense is going on, it's imminent. I would say once you're at the jail, probably at that point you're no longer permitted to struggle.
So when I read this case, and I am not a criminal lawyer at all, and so I'm not an expert on this, I always assumed that if the police arrest you, and you resist, you're going to be charged with a crime whether or not the initial arrest was legal or not. It surprised me that there's this whole doctrine that if the police don't have probable cause or whatever they're doing, you're allowed to actually physically attack a police officer. Wow. Is that true? Is that a majority rule in states?
No. Most states have gotten rid of that rule. I'm very glad we've
gotten rid of that. So they did have it. But
yes, other states have had it. I mean, Georgia, I mean, we were a prison colony. We have kind of that history behind us. We have we're one of the only states with a specific prohibition on imprisonment for debt, which actually can be really interesting. I think it's kind of part of that history, or maybe the legislature just hasn't gotten around to it yet.
So, you know, I bleed liberalism and progressivism, and I'm a bleeding heart. This rule seems crazy to me. Now, I guess what I might say is if we have evidence that the police officers intentionally acted in bad faith and the person being apprehended knew that, then maybe I could get behind this. But if it's just police officers making a normal mistake in the regular course of duties, the idea that you can physically resist them just strikes me as weird. It surprised me.
It is a pretty odd rule. And what makes it even crazier is that I think if you read the text of the statute, it says knowingly and willfully. Well, willfully typically means knowing that it's a crime. Knowingly kind of adds to that.
Well, who's knowingly and willfully?
Sorry, if you resist an officer in the course of his lawful duties willfully and knowingly, you commit the crime of obstruction. So there's a pretty okay argument, and the Court of Appeals has kind of held that you have to know that what you're doing is wrong, is illegal, when you resist the officer. So if you make a reasonable mistake of law that you can't be arrested, that itself might be a defense to obstruction. Now, from a policy matter, I actually like this rule. Maybe that's just a libertarian in me. I think that if officers have to be assured they're doing the right thing in the right way, they're more likely to follow the rules. And in fact, you kind of see this often. It's so funny how police will use no-knock warrants on people's homes when they know they're not armed, kind of bursting into the middle of the night. But when there's like an armed standoff or a hostage situation, they'll talk it out first. It seems like the perception of danger, rather than making police officers more reckless, sometimes makes them more cautious and more respectful of rights.
But certainly you can't use deadly force to resist arrest. I can't imagine. I mean, if I have a gun in my pocket and I'm being arrested by the police, and even in the worst of situations, if you're saying I have a right to take out my gun and shoot him in the head, that strikes me as perverse and bizarre.
Well, that could be murder. It might not be justified, but it might not be felony obstruction because you might not be offering violence knowing that you're willfully hindering the officer in the course of his lawful duties. So it's still a crime in other ways, and you have to prove justification. It's not enough. So it's only this one specific statute that says that the officer has to be acting lawfully. If you shoot or hurt a police officer otherwise, they could just charge you with ag battery, ag assault. And then you have to make the normal justification.
So they could charge this guy with destruction of property.
Which is what they did.
Yeah.
So they charge him with destruction of property. Right. And that's how they get him. And that's what the judge ends up finding. Well, okay, you're destroying property in the course of the arrest. This guy's like, no. I was preventing a forcible felony from being committed against me, the crimes of false imprisonment.
I just want to say that the state of Georgia should just have let this go, leaving aside the law. This is such a dumb thing for the state of Georgia to... The facts aren't very good for the state of Georgia. I mean, why would they even continue this?
Oh, I mean, prosecutors don't like to lose.
I know. No one does.
And to be honest, the guy's a jerk on the video. I mean, that's kind of it. He's kind of a...
And the dissent kind of mentioned that, right? Basically saying perhaps this is not our ideal plaintiff, but still.
Yeah, so right? Honestly, if you are a pleasant person and you are nice to the police officer and you resist in a passive way, then chances are very good that you'll have an easier time getting your case dismissed. Whereas if you curse a lot and kick and scream, that makes the case more difficult. So just like you say with judges, a lot of prosecutorial discretion is values. And there's no central clearinghouse that makes sure the prosecutors don't take up dumb cases. So there was a truly embarrassing oral argument a few years ago, I recommend you watch, about whether there was in Georgia, it was a crime to be mean to teachers. There was actually a statute about
really?
It.
Really?
Yes.
I should have arrested you 10 years ago.
So it was a crime to upbraid teachers, regardless of whether you disrupted school proceedings. And so this lady got up and argued, and she said, oh, well, if you're allowed to be mean to teachers, regardless of the First Amendment, there'll be another Columbine. Anyway, the argument was embarrassing. Nobody agreed with what she was saying. Everybody pretty much looked at the statute and said, this probably has to go. But because there's no overarching discretion over what the state defends, this Glynn County solicitor was allowed to make that argument. And the case is called West, by the way, if you want to check it out.
Check it out. And Mike, before we transition to Lewis, is there anything that you want to add on this case?
Oh, I think that you're exactly right on the imminence thing. It's a continuing tort. But I do think there's going to be a you know, just as a matter of tort law and false imprisonment, you get to use reasonable means to escape. And I guess the argument I'd make for the other side is that kicking the door in is not a reasonable means. So, but on the imminence, it seems to be you have to be right with that.
I think that's exactly. I mean, I think that is the better argument. But here, the Court of Appeals really said not that it was unreasonable force, which you're right would be a much better argument, but that legally he was not entitled to any justification defense at all because there was no imminence, which
no,
was a much weaker
I,
one.
I think
yeah,
that's, a weak
that's
one.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. I'm glad we all agree on that. Let's transition to our last case, Lewis. Mike, why don't you get us started on this?
Okay. Well, this is a case of a minimum wage law, and the federal minimum wage law is $7.25 an hour. And in Alabama, in Birmingham, the city council wanted to raise it to $10.10 an hour, and they had a dispute with the state going over several months about whether they could do this. And so one has to use specific dates here. On February 23rd, 2016, the city enacted an immediate, not a gradual, but an immediate increase to $10.10 an hour with a $100 a day penalty per day and per employee if the employer didn't follow this. And on the afternoon of February the 23rd, 2016, the state attorney general issued a press release. And I just have to quote some of it because it's going to matter a little
bit. And that's the same very day.
The same
right?
day, mm-hmm. yeah. Because this ordinance does not provide a reasonable time to comply, it could greatly disrupt the Birmingham economy. I am issuing this statement to prevent that disruption and to assure Birmingham businesses that despite the terms of the ordinance, they will have a reasonable time to prepare to comply. Under Alabama law, the ordinance cannot take effect immediately. Well, on the 24th, the mayor, the day after this, the mayor signed the ordinance into law. And on the 25th, the state legislature enacted a statute that overrode the ordinance, and the governor signed that.
So it all happened within 3 days.
So it all happened right then in
and
3 days.
And when you read Attorney General's note there, what does it mean to you, what he's saying?
It means that he's trying to calm a panic. That's what it means to be because
calm a panic among
it's a
the
39,
employers.
It's a 30. Yes, that's for 39% immediate wage increase. So what happened is there's this provision in the ordinance that you get to bring a suit against your employer if he doesn't give you the raise. But what happened in the case is this. This isn't a case between an employee and an employer
who is refusing
to do it. Mm-hmm. The plaintiffs structured the case differently. They got together some African American workers and some the NAACP and some other groups, and they brought a case that ultimately is against the state attorney general. Started it with other parties like the governor. But they brought a suit against the Alabama Attorney General, and they wanted a declaratory judgment that the Alabama statute violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution because mm-hmm. it's intentional discrimination based on race.
So they bring a constitutional
they
lawsuit
brought a
constitutional
in federal court. Suit in federal court. And the district judge dismissed the complaint for lack of standing. So. An important procedural part of the case is the complaint was dismissed, so there's been no presentation of evidence or anything like that. Well, a panel of the 11th Circuit reversed that, and now it's in the in-bank 11th Circuit. That's what this opinion is about. It's the in-bank opinion. And by now, the only defendant is the Attorney General. And there are three issues. One issue is the substantive equal protection issue. And another issue is whether or not the plaintiffs have standing. And a third issue is whether or not the Attorney General of Alabama is an appropriate defendant. And the court only got to the standing issue. It didn't deal with the other two. And on the standing issue, there are three prongs you have to meet. You have to show an injury. Well, they had an injury because they weren't getting the extra money. Mm-hmm. The economic injury is an injury. But you have to show that the injury is traceable to an act by the person you're suing, that is the Attorney General, and you have to show the third prong. You have to show that the relief you seek would redress the injury, traceability and redressability. And the majority opinion by Judge Newsom, for 7 of the 12 judges, says there's no standing because there's an injury, but we can't trace this to anything by the Alabama Attorney General, and relief against him in the form of a declaratory judgment or an injunction would not redress the injury.
What do you think is the court's main issue that they take with this lawsuit?
Well, the thing that they did was they said that you can't trace this to the Alabama Attorney General because all he did was, first he issued a press release, but that didn't have anything to do with the Alabama statute. The statute is what gets in their way, not something he did. They said, among other things, that no one contends that the Attorney General is actually affirmatively enforcing the act. The plaintiffs claim there was a specter of enforcement by the Attorney General, but the majority said that's just a specter. They quoted a dictionary. That's just a vision of the imagination. That's too insubstantial. The statute doesn't contemplate enforcement by the Attorney General. It contemplates enforcement by the employee suing the employer for the extra money.
So who can you trace the injury to?
Well, you would trace it to the employer who doesn't mm-hmm. pay you the money. And the way the thing would ordinarily be litigated would be the employer doesn't pay the money, and so you sue the employer, and the employer uses the Alabama statute as a defense. Mm-hmm. And then the plaintiff says, well, the Equal Protection Clause overrides the statute.
That's so bring constitutional claims indirectly.
Right.
Why do they not do that?
Well, that's what I was getting at. they said it wasn't traceable to the Attorney General, and they said on redressability, they basically said the opinion goes on for a long way and there's a long dissent, but the basic argument on redressability is that if you got relief against the Attorney General, that's not going to bind the employers, and they're not going to raise the pay by 39% until somebody actually orders them to. So it wasn't redressable. And the dissent by Judge Wilson, who had written the panel opinion, Judge Wilson, in dissent, his basic argument is that this complaint was dismissed. At this stage of the proceeding, you've got to make all reasonable inferences in the non-movement's favor. You've got to give people a chance to present evidence. And he could see a way in which the plaintiff could show traceability and redressability. That's the gist of it.
Go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say that I've written a lot about standing, as has Professor Wells, of course. And standing is what standing does. And on the merits, this case is really hard because there's every reason to think that the Alabama legislature passed this law for racist reasons. That's too complicated to prove right now, but I think it is. And the majority doesn't want to go there. So all I'm going to say about this is prior standing law could yield a result in either case, but like all cases involving standing that raise political issues, like the emoluments litigation against President Trump or a lot of other cases, what the judges did in this case is they peaked at the merits. They wanted no part of that, and so they dismissed the case for standing. But if you think about it, this is not the law, but if you think about it, once there's legally cognizable injury, which there was in this case, the majority that dismissed this case said,
in one paragraph,
losing money is obviously injury.
Right.
What caused you to lose money has to be, by definition, a factual question. And factual questions should not be resolved through standing analysis.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's the problem. But I do think there's another aspect of the case mm-hmm. that nobody talked about, and that is this issue of whether the Attorney General in an Ex parte Young suit is the proper party to sue. Because the ordinary way that this ex parte Young litigation is done, where you sue state officials to stop them from acting against federal law, the ordinary situation is one where he's actually done something or is threatening to do something. And the plaintiffs couldn't find anything he had really done. And in fact, I think probably the most important part of the opinion to me is that at the oral argument, the plaintiff's counsel conceded that if they had a good theory here against the state attorney general, this would apply to most provisions of Alabama law. So what it would do really is to change the ex parte Young doctrine into something you could sue whenever you wanted to challenge the state's law on a federal constitutional ground, because the Alabama attorney general has really broad enforcement authority under this statute 36-15-12. So it's really about a federalism issue. Should cases like this, which involve disputes between private parties, be adjudicated in these ex parte Young suits?
I don't think I agree with that. So just to back up real quickly, of course states have sovereign immunity and can't be sued unless they give their consent, or you're suing a state officer for prospective injunctive relief. And I have zero doubt that this attorney general would have enforced the Alabama law to trump the Birmingham law if in the right procedural context. Pre-enforcement challenges happen all the time. And what you say is, in this case, what the plaintiffs would say is, my employer would have to pay me what the Birmingham ordinance requires him to pay me if it wasn't for the state law preempting it, but the state law is unconstitutional. And I don't, so there's a case called Edna versus Hayworth from the 1940s. It's actually kind of a ripeness mootness case, but what the court said was, it's the nature of the controversy, not who brings it, that's important. Now I concede under Supreme Court precedent, your argument is probably, would persuade the conservatives on the court, but I actually think here, look, Birmingham promised you a minimum wage. You're not getting that. That's injury, and the court concedes that. Why are you not getting that? Because there is a state law that trumps it. The attorney general would have enforced that state law in the proper proceeding. Pre-enforcement relief is perfectly appropriate in that context, in my opinion.
Well, I think the way you put it is right. Let's say he would have enforced it, but you have to show that it's right. You have to show a threat. Well, and he hasn't done anything that would amount to a threat.
So if you wait a year, is there a case?
Pardon?
If you wait a year, is there a case?
If you wait a year, if you wait a year and he hasn't done anything, it suggests it wasn't right.
So there's actually law on this. I mean, the test is there a concrete and definite threat of enforcement? I mean, that's
and
the
I just
law.
I don't see, put it in your terms, I just don't see this threat of enforcement. There's another point. I don't know anything about Alabama law, but William Pryor and he said and I have no idea if he's right. He said the Alabama Attorney General can't do this enforcement that you talk about. But I'd say even if he could do it, until he is threatened to do it, I don't think that there's a good suit against him. And I do think that the way that the plaintiffs structured the case is one in which they want to really expand the role of federal courts to include cases in which the officer hasn't acted yet, but would have, to put it in your terms, would have acted.
Well, I think the answer then is this should have been dismissed under 12b-6, failure to state a claim, not standing.
Oh, I think the standing argument is bad. I agree. I think that this, like you were saying earlier, traceability and redressability are questions of fact, and you know the whole idea of deciding them and a motion to dismiss is ridiculous.
Example, if they had discovery, which they were not allowed, they might have found some memos from the Attorney General saying, I'm going to enforce this law with vigor. And the reason I say that is this on the merits is a case that raises serious questions. I'm not saying who's right or wrong, but serious questions of racial discrimination. So potentially. So if they had discovery, they might have found out the Attorney General was you know, one who was pushing for this law. I mean, who knows? They should have had that discovery if their legal claims could state a claim if everything they said was true.
Okay, well, the only answer I give to that is that I'd like to see something more than a memo to make the threat and to make it
fair
live.
Enough.
That's all.
Fair enough.
And to conclude, just Eric, unpack a little bit the 12b-6 thing. What would have been the argument if you were to dismiss it on that ground?
Well, I think the argument is the Attorney General is never the appropriate party, no matter what you find in this kind of lawsuit. But that's clearly wrong in this case, which is why this case should not have been dismissed for lack of standing, and at this point in the proceedings, shouldn't be dismissed for 12b-6 either. Someday in the future it might, but the plaintiff should have gotten discovery.
That sounds good. That's a good note to end on. Thank you all so very much for such a wonderful discussion, and thank you guys for coming. We're going to wrap it up.